and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. If you listened to yesterday's morning show, then you heard my conversation with Beverly Gooden, the author of a very important book called Surviving, Why We Stay and How We Leave Abusive Relationships. Today, we are going to be continuing to focus on this topic, but through a more local lens. I'm so pleased to be able to speak today for the first time in the morning show with Susie Shainhoft, who is the executive director of New Beginnings, whose official name is actually the Association for the Prevention of Family Violence. They are located in Walworth County with their primary bases of operation in Elkhorn and Whitewater. And we're going to be finding out from Susie Shainhoft about the kind of work that New Beginnings does and the sort of resources that they have to offer. And we'll also try to explore with her a bit more about the phenomenon of domestic violence and what tends to precipitate it and what we can do to combat it, and also what is most important for us to do for those who find themselves caught in this awful, difficult situation. And of course, the name of the agency suggests that new, exciting, wonderful beginnings and possibilities are within reach for people who find themselves in this unhappy situation. Susie Shainhoft, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you, Greg. I appreciate the invite.
I'm really glad that we can be having this conversation. WGTD tries to remember that our listening area extends all the way to the good people of Walworth County, or at least most of Walworth County, and I'm really glad that we can be having this conversation today and talk about some of the important work that you and your colleagues do. Let's begin with something as basic as when and by whom and under what circumstances your agency, now known as New Beginnings, was created.
Well, it was way back in 1977. It began as a task force, and they called themselves the Association for the Prevention of Family Violence, which no one seemed to be able to remember, so they shortened it to APFV. And that task force was primarily made up of women who had been abused, law enforcement, clergy, human services professionals, and some concerned citizens. And that first year that they had formulated their task force, they received approximately 500 calls. And so it was at that point that they felt we need to offer services for all of these people in Walworth County. And so in 1978, APFV became incorporated, and we opened our very first office.
Wow.
And that was opened in Walworth County.
What's kind of scary is to think about what somebody would do before 1977, if you lived in Walworth County, and if you were living in a situation with domestic abuse or domestic violence. Do you have any sense of what somebody then, before New Beginnings, what would they have done? What would be the options available to somebody who found themselves in this kind of terrible situation?
Well, to me, it sounds like they went to the police and they went to their clergy, and I believe it is because they went to the police and their clergy that this task force was originally initiated, because they were getting so many calls and they thought there is a big problem here and we need to offer some kind of help. And knowing that they weren't they're professionals, but not professionals in the field, so to speak. So I believe that's what led to this, because the only options that anyone who was being abused back in the day, the only option was to go to the police or clergy or a friend, and perhaps human services, because they were involved as well.
Wow.
But it was quite limited.
Right. So what would you say is the central mission then of New Beginnings?
Well, our mission is to provide services to victims of violent crimes. So we have five core service areas, and that includes domestic violence, sexual assault, stalking, harassment, and now, unfortunately, human trafficking. So those core service areas, sexual assault was initiated in 2001 for very much of the same reason. There were more and more calls that we would receive, not about just domestic violence, but also about sexual assault. So in 2001, we began offering services for sexual assault and became a dual service agency. And then between 2012 and 2017, again, we saw increases in stalking, harassment, and human trafficking. So then we tagged on those services additionally.
Wow. How long have you been with New Beginnings?
I've been here about 2.5 years. I've been in the field 33, but I've been here at New Beginnings 2.5 years, and the draw for me was just providing services to everybody who needs it, including children, adults, seniors. I have a little background in working with both kids and seniors, as well as adults, and so there was quite a draw that New Beginnings provides services to everybody. All of our services are completely free and confidential to all of those that we work with, and that was the draw for me.
Wow. Before we dig into a little more of what New Beginnings specifically has to offer, I wonder if you could just talk about the more than three decades that you have been working in this field, and in a sense, what you have seen over the course of that long period of time in terms of how this work has changed. Progress, has it been made, or is this a problem that seems to be worsening or changing? I mean, what at least in general, have you seen over the course of those 33 years?
Well, sadly, I don't think in my lifetime I'll be out of a job. And when I started many years ago, I thought, oh, gosh, I hope to find a solution, not personally, but, you know, within the field and within our world, find a solution. And sadly, a lot hasn't changed. I think the positive is that there is much more inclusion and there's much more acceptance and there's much more, well, I'll say acceptance. People are understanding that it is happening in their neighborhoods all around them, with people, inevitably, that they know. And I think that that's probably the biggest change that I've seen. Instead of keeping it hush-hush under the covers, people are willing to talk about it and are feeling the need to talk about it. Organizations such as New Beginnings are more accepted. And I think that all of that's very important. You know, knowledge is power.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Susie Shainhoft, who is Executive Director of of the Association for the Prevention of Family Violence, known more familiarly or affectionately as New Beginnings. They are headquartered in Walworth County, primarily with their bases of operation in Elkhorn and Whitewater, and they offer a host of resources for victims of violent crime. We do want to focus at least most of this conversation today specifically on the matter of domestic violence, and of course that is at the heart of when the agency was originally formulated back in the late 1970s. But in terms of the resources that you offer, feel free to share at least a little bit about some of what you offer even outside of the realm of domestic violence.
Sure, I'd love to. So the services, they're plentiful. We do offer 24-hour crisis lines. So if someone calls our number after office hours, they have three options, and the options are to leave a message for us to call back the next day, if it's an emergency to call 911, and if they would like to speak with someone immediately, to press, I believe it's number 5, and they will be directed right to a crisis worker. So that is a fantastic service that we offer. We offer safety planning, and that oftentimes it's in the form of us assisting with a TRO, which is known as a temporary restraining order. We assist with legal advocacy in criminal and civil court cases. We also offer 24 hours a day, SANE representation. So a lot of acronyms here, and I apologize for that. SANE stands for Sexual Assault Nursing Exam, known to most people as a rape kit. So if someone is sexually assaulted and goes to the hospital, we go to Lakeland, which is Advocate Aurora Hospital. We have an agreement with them. We're on call 24 hours a day. We have 14 SANE volunteers that sign up to be on call. And if someone goes in and wants advocacy, then they are called and go into the hospital for that advocacy. We offer safe emergency housing support groups. We run 6 support groups out of our building, and we also run support groups at some of the local schools. We have personal advocacy and follow-up with our clients, individual counseling by licensed professionals. Programming. We have programming for children, teens, adults, and seniors. We have an information and referral resource binder that we use extensively. We work very closely with many, many partners in our community for a coordinated community response. And that's just to assist anybody in need in a holistic approach. And then the biggie is that we offer community education and awareness. 2021, we did 109 awareness events in our community. And getting the word out there and working on prevention is a large piece of what we do.
Wow. How big a staff are we talking about in order to facilitate all that you just described?
Well, there are only 12 of us, including myself, and 2 are part-time and 10 are full-time.
And who is the primary funder? And under whose auspices do you operate?
Well, primarily we operate on grant funding. So DCF, Department of Children and Family Services, as well as VOCA, which is the Victim of Crime Act. Those are our 2 biggest grants that keep our office up and running. We also work with some state and local funders that we apply for grants, such as United Way. We're very blessed and fortunate to have some community support and backing in the form of funding. And then the other 15 to 20%, we rely on donors, and we rely on whether that be corporate donors or private donors.
And do you have some kind of official connection to, for instance, the Walworth County government or the Walworth County Department of Human Services, or are you more of a freestanding independent operation?
We're freestanding. They are allies, and we work extremely closely with them, but we are freestanding. We're not a government entity.
And who is eligible to access the many resources that you have available?
any victim of a violent crime and or a family member. So we not only provide services to the primary victim, which is the individual who the abuse or assault happened to, but we also, for instance, if there is a child who was sexually molested, we also offer services to that family member or those family members. Oftentimes parents feel guilt and blame and shame because something like this happened to their child, and they are seeking services in the form of counseling or family counseling or individual counseling. So we work with both primary and secondary victims of violent crime.
And I assume they need to be residents of Walworth County.
They actually don't. We serve all of Walworth County and the southern portion of Jefferson County. In 2018, we opened an outreach office in Whitewater on Main Street, and so those are our two offices. More recently, we are in the Workforce Development Building in Jefferson County. The county was wonderful. They gave us some in-kind space to work from. We also have office hours at UW-Whitewater in the Ambrose Medical Center. So we are spread out, and we are able to work with anybody that comes to us. We don't turn anyone down. Primarily, I'd say 85% of the clients we see are from Walworth and or Jefferson County. For instance, though, I'll give you an example. Lake Geneva is a big tourist town, and we recently worked with a woman who had been sexually assaulted. She was here visiting from Michigan. We still offered the services to her when she called us, and they were very short-term because, again, she didn't live locally, but we will work with people from any county if they are in need. We do have many, many partners, and in our 72 counties in Wisconsin, we've got service providers that we collaborate with often. And if it makes sense, we will certainly refer to one of our partners, but we would not turn someone down because they don't live in Walworth County or Jefferson County.
Are you able to offer all that you want to offer? I guess really what I'm getting at with this question is there a waiting list? Or, is your relatively small staff able to facilitate all that you intend and want to offer to the public?
We do it, yes. There are no waiting lists, and we pride ourselves on that, particularly for our counseling. Some of the hospitals in the area that offer counseling or counseling centers, there are 6 to 8 week waiting lists, and we are oftentimes same-day waiting lists, and if not the same day, within a week. Because it's crisis, it's really important for us to work with the individual in need at the time of the call or when they walk in, and we do have walk-in services. So if someone just walks in off the street, we help them then and there. And the 12 of us are able to get it done, and we're very proud of that.
As you should be. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Susie Schenhoft, who is the executive director of the Walworth County agency known as the Association for the Prevention of Family Violence, or New Beginnings, with offices in Elkhorn and Whitewater, and as she was just recounting, also operating now in a portion of Jefferson County as well, and offering a wide array of resources to people who find themselves the victim, the target of crime, and in particular for our purposes today, those who are caught in a situation of domestic violence. And we're having this conversation today again in follow-up to an author interview that aired on yesterday's morning show, in which I spoke with Beverly Gooden, the author of Surviving, Why We Stay and How We Leave Abusive Relationships, in which Beverly Gooden shared her own story of finding herself in a marriage that began very happily, but then descended into something very dark and dangerous when her husband began to abuse her in a number of different ways. Hence the conversation that we are having today with Susie Schenhoft from New Beginnings. I'm pleased that you are drawing from such a rich well of personal experience in terms of having worked in this area for such a long time, more than three decades, as you were saying earlier. For all that we have come to understand about domestic violence, do we still grapple to understand just what exactly causes it? And is it simplistic to even think in those terms about what it is that tends to cause or trigger domestic violence?
Well, I think the main cause is a need and desire for power and control. I think that so many people believe it's just an anger issue and, oh, they need anger management and they'll be fine. When in reality, the causes are need for power and control. We have, and what we use in the field, it's called the power and control wheel, and it takes you step by step what it might look like to come up against someone with power and control issues, what it might sound like, how it feels. And the bottom line, the easy answer to that question is power and control. And I think, again, the biggest misconception is that it's about anger and angry person.
Hmm. That also speaks to something else that I don't think we've touched on yet, and I think it's probably important for us to say that although we almost always think about this and hear about this in terms of a woman being the target of domestic violence, it is not always the case that, in fact, domestic violence can go the other direction, and indeed even in same-sex relationships, domestic violence can also occur, and I'm sure that is something that you and your colleagues see all the time as you engage in this important work.
It is. Approximately 1 in 4 women are victims of domestic violence, but 1 in 7 men are as well. And that's a much higher number than most people would imagine that it is.
Wow.
Approximately 80% of our clientele here at New Beginnings, they're female, or those who identify as female. But we do, and we have seen a steady, slow, but steady increase in male victims as well. And you touched base in the LGBTQ plus population. The instances of abuse are almost higher than they are in a heterosexual population. And so I think that in the future that number may increase a little bit, and I think that we may start seeing a little bit more. As I alluded to earlier, there is more of an acceptance now. And I think 20 years ago, I think a man would have had a very difficult time coming in for help. And our numbers would back that sentiment. But now I think it's more accepted. We make sure that when we are out promoting New Beginnings and presenting for awareness events, we always include men or people that identify as men in our presentations, because it does happen and it is happening.
I see now what you were saying, that 20 years ago, a man who was the target of domestic violence would probably have felt a real profound reluctance to step forward and say probably anything to anybody, even
Absolutely.
To a close friend or relative. That might have been a tremendously difficult thing to reveal to anybody else. And now you're saying that we probably are living now in a culture or climate where it is maybe a little easier matter for a man to step forward and say that they are experiencing this.
I agree. I think that the landscape is shifting. It meaning domestic violence, has really historically always been been referred to as the women, battered women, abused women. And the landscape has shifted and continues to shift, and services, all of the services that we offer for women, we also offer for men.
Hmm. So I was so anxious to ask you about whether or not we tend to see domestic violence in particular constituencies of society. I mean, for instance, does it tend to be people of a certain age or of a certain economic class or certain ethnic groups do we see more of this? Or is this something that are we more likely to see it in one of the bigger metropolitan areas of Walworth County, like Whitewater, for instance? Or are we just as apt to see this in very, very small rural communities? Where are we seeing this? Or do we just see it everywhere, in a sense?
Sadly, we see it everywhere. It happens in every geographic location, every economic status, social status, with each and every gender, religion, race. It is happening everywhere. As far as age, there is a bit of an age where it happens the most, and nearly 65% of those we see are aged between 25 and 59. But, you know, on the other hand, we do see teenagers who are in a teen dating violence situation. And we also see seniors who are abused as well, if not by a spouse or a family member, by a caregiver. So although those are a little bit more rare, the average is between age 25 and 59. We're rural out here, and 99% of the people that we work with are from rural areas. I think part of it, back when it started, New Beginning started in 1977, part of it is the seclusion of a rural area. If you live in the city where you're an arm's length away from your neighbor's apartment building, if there's a fight, if there's broken glass, if there's noise involved in an abuse situation, if you don't or can't call the police, somebody else could. Not that they always would, but they could. And out in rural areas, it's difficult. You could be on multiple acres, the only home on multiple acres, and no one would hear or see that anything is happening. So it definitely, rural areas definitely, We see a lot of the abuse situations out here, and I think that's one of the reasons why.
Wow. You know, I have never stopped to think about that, and I suspect that's true of a lot of our listeners as well, that this is one more example of where, you know, we might think of rural America in very idyllic terms, but in fact we have to be really, really careful, because there are certain things exactly about rural America and sparsely populated areas where certain very sort of dark forces can gain ground. And it is exactly the kind of place where domestic violence might be more apt to occur, exactly because of that isolation. That is a really sort of scary to think about, and it makes the work that you and your colleagues do all the more important.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And a lot of people don't think about that, you know, and it's something very important, one, but two, it's very common. We see it a lot, and it's very common.
So when we're talking about a household in which domestic violence emerges, do we see things that we might think of as triggers for that kind of behavior or activity? Or maybe another way to frame the question would be, are there particular risk factors that will often be present when something like this emerges in the home?
Well, the bottom line is the power and control. And so if an individual who has issues with the power and control, if they're challenged or perceived as being challenged, that can be a trigger for them to explode. And it doesn't have to be much or anything at all, because a lot of it is just perceived. And so if the abuser or the perpetrator perceives a situation where they feel they may be losing some of that power and or control, that oftentimes is a trigger. Sometimes if there's any kind of conflict or disagreement with the person who's holding all that power and control, it's almost a how dare you type thing, and that can trigger them into a spiral where they begin or continue the abusive behavior, whether that be verbal or physical or sexual or all three.
One of the sort of central themes of the book that was the subject of yesterday's morning show, this book called Surviving, was the story of the author Beverly Gooden, who actually is the person who coined or developed the Twitter hashtag #WhyWeStay. And so you understand the context, in 2014, when this viral video was released, in which NFL football player Ray Rice was seen, I think maybe in a hotel or apartment elevator, beating up his fiance,
yes.
And you know, there was shock and outrage. But also with that shock was also the question that kept emerging, and was sometimes rather insensitively phrased, but the question is, why is she with him? Why would any intelligent, self-respecting woman stay with a man who does this to her? Why does she stay? And Beverly Gooden became sort of increasingly disturbed by kind of the way that question was sometimes being phrased, and what she felt was really unkind, insensitive fashion. And that's why she created this hashtag #WhyWeStay, or I forget now exactly what it was, but and told her story of trying to explain why she found it difficult to leave this relationship. And not surprisingly, tens of thousands of others responded to that hashtag with their own stories about why they found it difficult to leave an abusive relationship. And this book, Surviving, is an expansion on that initial exploration of this intriguing question. I'm curious, what has your experience in this field taught you about that question of why people find it difficult to leave an abusive relationship? What typically are the sorts of things that have them remaining when it seems like they should be leaving?
And that's a great question. There are a plethora of reasons why people stay. On average, it takes, on average, again, approximately 7 attempts before someone who is being abused leaves for good. To the outside eye, the lens looking in, people don't understand it. We hear and see still a lot when we're out fundraising. People will willingly give to puppies and kittens and children, but they say, well, I'm not going to give to you because if someone hit me, I'd just walk out. I'd just leave. And we hear a lot of that often. And I can only imagine as a survivor how brave it is, one, to tell your story, but two, how frustrating to hear comments like that. There are so many reasons, and it's different for each person, but because of this power and this control, oftentimes the victims of domestic violence or interpersonal violence stay because they have to make a plan that makes sense. Oftentimes they are not allowed to work, so they are lacking skills, and it's not so easy for them to go out and get a job. Oftentimes, because of power and control, the abuser is in charge of the couple's money and funds. The victim and survivor, oftentimes, they don't even have access to their bank numbers, let alone taking money out to flee. Sometimes they don't have vehicles or cars. There is one automobile in the entire family, and that is used by the abuser. They oftentimes don't have any natural supports. So when I say natural supports, I mean family, friends, neighbors, coworkers, if they work, people to rely on because their abuser has ensured over time that they no longer have anyone or any bonding relationships other than with the abuser. So those are just a few of the examples, and they're some of the most common examples that we see and hear about. But when you have no money, you have no supports, you have no job skills, you sit and you ask yourself, well, gosh, I don't want to stay. I want to leave, but how can I leave without money, without transportation, without natural supports? And that, to me, those are some of the main reasons why people stay, even though to the outside eye it seems ridiculous and scary and frightening. Those are some very, very real reasons. In addition to fear, in addition to fear of not being believed, fear of will he or she come after me and try to kill me, because oftentimes that is a threat to make people stay. And all of those things come into play. It's not an easy thing to do. It takes a tremendous amount of bravery and courage. And it also takes being logical and having a realistic plan. Okay, if I leave tomorrow, where am I going to go? How am I going to get there? If I can stay somewhere a day, that helps me that day, but what about long term? And those are some very real factors that come into play when someone is contemplating leaving.
One of the things that Beverly Gooden describes in her book, Surviving, is, and I know this is something that often people will do as they are contemplating leaving a situation, is they will formulate some kind of plan, and then they will formulate, begin constructing, I can't remember what her term was, but some kind of bag in which they are trying to put in certain things that they will need that will come in handy for that moment when they flee. But as she's describing this in the book, I just kept thinking to myself, what if he found that? What if he found that?
Right.
I mean, before you've even walked out the door, it takes tremendous courage just to make that decision that it's time to leave, and then to kind of gather whatever meager resources you can without being detected in order
right.
then to make that escape. I mean, I came away from reading that with a profound appreciation that I never had before for what it means for somebody to, in fact, try to escape this kind of awfulness.
The level of fear has got to be incredible. You nailed it. I think a lot of people hesitate in preparing that bag. Some do, and over months and some even years, they stash some money and they stash things that are important and try to hide it throughout their home or their car, and some even outside the house. But that level of fear that is present during that planning has got to be almost unbearable, almost like watching a very scary movie that you can't turn off.
Exactly. So what tends to be the trigger or the breaking point where somebody who has perhaps endured abuse for years makes that break? From the conversations you've had with people who have done that, can we point to anything that tends to be the tipping point or breaking point for them?
Not collectively. That's a very individual decision. We had a woman here last week, and her breaking point was she was always the one that was hit and kicked and abused, and her husband, the perpetrator, then turned it on her child. And for her, it had always just been her. And she was able in her mind to accept and live like that. But when he turned it on to her young child, that was the breaking point for her. And she said, "You've done this to me. I know what it feels like. I know what it does to a person, and you're not doing this to our child." And so she decided on that day that he hit their child that she was going to leave. So it's different for everyone. Sometimes people are just so beat down and worn out that they come to a realization that they cannot go another day like this. And sometimes it's because the injuries are getting more severe, and there's a whole new level of fear. You know, it may have gone from a slap or a push to now broken bones. And oftentimes that's the way people leave. He would have killed me if I stayed. She would have killed me if I stayed. And so it is. It's very individual. And for each person, I know it sounds like a generic answer, but for each person it is very different on what pushes them to that point, that breaking point where they say, "I've got to get out of here."
Right. And, of course, one can even imagine scenarios where somebody who wants to leave, who wants to get help, doesn't even know what help is potentially out there. But for those who do, for instance, somehow know about New Beginnings and are able to pick up a phone and reach out to you, what typically then is the response of New Beginnings? What are you, especially at that initial point, able to offer somebody who wants to escape?
Well, safety is the most important thing to us for our clients, and it's always the first question we ask. Are you in a safe place now? Are you currently in danger? Because many abusers will put GPS apps on phones and cars and computers, and oftentimes they have cameras and are recording. For us, whenever we get a call, the primary question that we ask is, are you safe right now? We encourage people to come in if they are able. We have a blind line here so that if we need to call someone, it doesn't pop up New Beginnings, because it would be very easy, if you don't know, to look up what we do. So we have a lot of safety features in place to ensure that the people who reach out to us for help are in a good place. Our website, we have a quick exit button. So if they go on our website to look for information, there's a quick exit that it's one click of one box and they're out of that website.
Wow.
So it's sad that that's needed, but it is.
and how great though that somebody thought of that. I mean, it means that to do this work well is not just to be kind-hearted and compassionate, but also really smart and savvy, because you need to be even smarter and even more savvy than the abuser in order to really help those who are caught in this.
We do have a responsibility to think of all of that, and unfortunately, a lot of abusers are very savvy, and you're right, we have to one-up them, and we have to be ahead of the game. So when people call, the most important thing for us to do is make sure that they're safe, and those are just a couple of examples of what we do to ensure that. But, you know, we allow people to come in when they're able. If they can't make it here, we oftentimes will meet them in a safe location. We refer to that as mobile advocacy, and we just let them, we go by a client-driven model here, so we never want to take away any power or control from anyone that we see here. And although sometimes we would love to suggest, my gosh, get out of there today, what are you thinking? But because it's client-driven, we never take any power or control away. So we go at the pace that each client wants and feels comfortable going. They lead us, and we assist in what areas they are needing the most help. We do offer and explain to them all of the services that we provide, and then we let them choose and select what they're ready for on the day that we see them. It's a process.
Right. Generally speaking, where does that process end? At what point typically does someone who is accessing your services, in a sense, move on into that new beginning, into that next chapter? I guess maybe a more graceful way to ask the question is, how far along in this arc, in this process, do your resources, do what you offer, extend?
Well, healing looks different for everybody, and we will work with a client as long as needed. Oftentimes, sadly, what we see is we'll work with a client, say, in 2020, and we get to the end of the process, we feel is the end of the process, and a year later they'll call back and they'll say, I'm still struggling, can I see you again? Some people have never left from 2020. They're still with us because they feel they need that ongoing support. And some people come to us years later and say, you know, I came here years ago for assistance, and I'm really struggling on A, B, or C. can you please help me? And we do all three of those things. We don't encourage people to leave our services if they're not ready to do so. And we certainly, just as there are patterns of behavior with offenders, sometimes there can be patterns of behavior with survivors. And there are, sometimes there are, people slip and they're doing real well, but this is trauma. And trauma hits people differently. And so the fact that someone may call a year later and say, boy, this triggered me or that triggered me or it's been a year, I've been on my own. Can I come in and talk to you about what's gone on? And we're more than happy to work with anybody who comes for any reason related to abuse and assault and trauma.
Hmm. For anybody listening to this who would like to help, to somehow be a part of the important work that you are doing, what would you say to them? What would be some ways in which people out in the community can be of some kind of assistance to you?
Just if you see something, say something is number one. Don't hesitate to say something if you have an inclination that there is abuse going on, whether that be with a child, an adult, or a senior. If you see that we're out offering a community awareness event, tell people about it. Let them know this might be a really good thing for us to go to just to learn a little bit more about others in our community. And as far as volunteering, we do have those SANE volunteers, the sexual assault nursing exam volunteers that I spoke of. Right now, we have all women volunteers, although we do have male advocates, paid advocates. Anyone who wants to volunteer for that, we do an extensive training. And we offer support through training throughout the year. And we would love to have more SANE volunteers. You can never have enough of those. And that would probably be most helpful as far as volunteers go. Those are the areas that we could use the most help.
The last thing I wanted to mention is when you go on the website for New Beginnings, I'm pretty sure somebody sees a question on that front page. Do you remember what I'm talking about?
Yes. Are you being abused? Are you being harmed?
Right. I so appreciate the simplicity and the directness of that. And sometimes that's all it takes in terms of really making a connection with somebody. And at a glance, one knows that this is an agency that really cares. And I appreciate the clarity and directness and the comprehensiveness of all that you offer to people who find themselves in this situation. Susie Shainhoft is Executive Director of the Association for Prevention of Family Violence, otherwise known as New Beginnings. They operate in Walworth County and a portion of Jefferson County with primary offices in both Elkhorn and Whitewater. Susie Shainhoff, I so appreciate you taking the time for this conversation today and certainly appreciate the good work that you and all of your colleagues do. Thank you so much and very best wishes to you.
Oh, thank you, Greg. I'm grateful you had us on. I appreciate it.
We have a very interesting array of morning shows scheduled for next week. I hope you will be able to join us for each and every one of these conversations. We'll have three author interviews on Monday, including Michael Johnston, who's created a wonderfully entertaining series for young readers titled Confessions of a Dork Lord, kind of a humorous twist on the Harry Potter legacy. On Tuesday, a conversation recorded with three alums of Kemper Hall, that wonderful all-girls school existed in Kenosha for over a century. They have just celebrated the 150th anniversary of their founding. On Wednesday, Susan Stryker, the author of a book called Transgender History. On Thursday, the last day of Pride Month, Barbara Farrar from the LGBT Center for Southeastern Wisconsin. And a week from today, Mark Eichner and the 100th season of Music Making of the Racine.